Okay, we're back, and we have on the line Osmond Faruqi, who is a journalist for Saturday Paper and the 7am podcast, and frequently in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age newspapers. Osmond's written an article for the Sydney Morning Herald recently called The Simple Measures Needed as Lockdown Exhaustion Hits, which is on the 25th of July. Welcome, Osmond.
G'day. Thanks so much for having me up.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So there were quite a few issues that you raised in the article that you wrote, and it covers quite a lot of bases. So I just wanted to thought it'd be good to get you on just to talk about how the pandemic has it's really sort of brought up to the surface a lot of fundamental issues about our society that were previously sort of covered over and difficult to sort of to see in plain view. And I think that you have sort of brought up a bunch of these issues quite clearly in the article. Just wanted to sort of maybe firstly just talk about the way that the response to the virus in both Victoria and New South Wales has brought out both sort of xenophobia and the way that we have a sort of inclination to police the less fortunate, the precarious workers, and just have a massive sort of police and now military response in order to control the virus and to get ourselves out of it.
Sure. I mean, firstly, thanks for reading the article and it resonating and you wanting to talk to me about it. I'm glad that people found it useful. I was sort of prompted to write it because I felt like I was kind of losing my mind watching so many people in Australia, so many politicians, including those from the progressive side of politics, demand harsher rules and more policing and even the use of the military as a way to resolve what is first and foremost a public health issue. But you're right. When you cast your mind back to the start of this pandemic last year, Australia really lent much more heavily into things like really restrictive border closures and really punitive policing as a way to deal with the pandemic. And on the surface, you know, you can understand that there's a logic in this virus is coming from external territories. So how do we keep ourselves safe? But I think the problem is in the context of Australian border control and border policy more generally, and the way that so many politicians use it as and use that kind of rhetoric as a way to keep the public safe or as a way to make them feel like they're safe, at least, it kind of became the primary measure to the detriment of anything else. So Australia closed its borders much harder and much faster than literally any other nation in the world, has kept them closed for so long. That obviously has had enormous social consequences for so many people, not just, you know, people with migrant backgrounds who've got family overseas that they can't see, but all sorts of Australians that are trapped here or trapped overseas and can't be with loved ones or friends. And then when you look at the domestic political context, you raise the issue of policing. Again, there's not many countries that have instituted fines and compliance regimes as strict as Australia. Even now, looking at 300 soldiers being rolled out across the incredibly culturally diverse and socioeconomically disadvantaged southwestern suburbs of Sydney, communities where, for a whole bunch of reasons, the virus continues to spread, largely because of essential work, because of lack of proper communication from the government to the people who live there. And the response from the government to all of these challenges, we saw it in Victoria during the second wave, the way that public housing towers were locked down. The response to these issues isn't how do we best solve this from a public health perspective. How do we keep people safe? How do we engage communities? How do we, you know, ramp up things like vaccinations? Instead, it's let's shut down the borders externally, let's shut down the borders internally, and let's use the police and the military as a way to try and stamp out this virus. It just doesn't seem to be effective, and it doesn't seem to be fair or just either.
You think I've noticed that, like, Australia has this history of like, it's very isolationist. It's obviously, we're far away from a lot of other countries, and we're formerly a British colony, which is pretty much the exact other side of the world, and we really feel that. And obviously, in the last couple of decades, we've treated refugees and people coming to the shores of Australia just absolutely appallingly, and just have this, I don't know, like I'm not sure how much is being fed by the leadership, by the ruling class, and how much is organic from the culture that we have ourselves, this sort of like prickly feeling of constantly being invaded. And then when the pandemic hit, it became such a good excuse for all of these attitudes to come to the surface and have a legitimate reason for closing the borders. Do you think that this is reaching into our history in some way, and that it's touching on something? Do you think that there's something broiling up from the underside of our culture, or is it being sort of imposed on from above and we're just following along?
It's a really great question, and it's a bit of a cliche or maybe a boring answer, but it is a bit of both. You know, I think I'm sort of, and I'm sure like yourself, a bit reluctant to blame ordinary people for so many of the problems that our political class has created. But I think there's two things going on. I think you're right. Australia, white Australia since day one, has created a narrative of Australia that is about, we got here, this is our land, and no one else is allowed to take it from us. And that has been manifested throughout the history of Australian politics, including from the progressive side. You know, you can't forget that the very first act of the Federated Australian Commonwealth was the Immigration Restriction Act, the White Australia policy. There's been a long-standing cultural and political position in Australia that the solution here on almost any issue from, you know, what was the purpose of the Immigration Restriction Act? It was ostensibly about wage control and stopping, you know, those quote-unquote dirty foreigners driving down wages and stealing. To everything from economic policy to now public health policy, the solution is seen as restrictive borders. And I think there was a really significant tipping point last year that so many people still don't remember, but it was one that sent chills down my spine. It was the decision of the Australian government to use the Christmas Island Detention Centre as a emergency quarantine facility exclusively for Australians and permanent residents returning from Wuhan, China. And that was obviously extremely significant because, as you mentioned refugee policy and the awful way the government treats asylum seekers. There was a direct line between that and what we saw with the pandemic. So obviously Australia set up Christmas Island as an offshore detention centre for years, for decades now. When white Australians on cruise ships were returning at that early stage of the pandemic, they were allowed to return onto the mainland. But when we wanted to bring back Chinese Australians, we sent them to a centre that up until then had only ever been used for asylum seekers or refugees.
Yeah, that's actually really good observation. I hadn't actually connected those two things. When the Ruby Princess landed in Sydney, of course, everyone was allowed to disembark and then create a massive outbreak at the time. And that was almost the same time that Chinese people were being locked up in a camp. Like, in Australia, our solution is often lock people up in a camp.
And you can see, I mean, the fact that people just went along with it. I mean, imagine the images if hundreds of white Australians were locked up on Christmas Island. I think that would shatter a lot of illusions or myths that white Australians in particular in this country have about how border control works.
And similarly, when more recently, when Delta strain was first coming out of India, of course, the immediate response was to block immigration or like any kind of people coming in from India. And yet, like, there are still the same number of restrictions on people coming from elsewhere, even if they had the exact same variant arriving into Australia.
Yeah, it's worth remembering, again, there's so many things that happened last year that quite understandably we have, you know, just moved on from because it's been such a wild and weird rollercoaster over the past 18 months. But you look at the way that Australia closed its borders one by one. It closed the borders to China, to Iran, and to Italy. But when it came time to, like, you know, remember before other countries started to really feel the heat of the pandemic, the US and the UK were right up there. I mean, the US was so bad. Peter Dutton, remember, who at the time was the Minister for Home Affairs, he actually went to the United States, caught COVID, and brought it back to Australia. Australia has never instituted a specific ban on travel from the United States or the UK. As soon as the virus became clear that it was there, it became a national or an international worldwide travel ban. Mm. And there's been a consistent difference. If you look at the numbers that the Department of Home Affairs has released in terms of where exemptions are being granted, in terms of where people can travel from, there's a distinct class and racial bias. It seems completely disconnected from where the virus is. It just seems to prioritize wealthy European countries at the detriment of the developing world.
And in terms of the internal response, do you feel like for journalists, it is very difficult to sort of bring up these kinds of points that people are very, not necessarily ordinary people, but media organisations in the state have a particular line, and that if you deviate from it, it just becomes a bit more difficult to express these views. Like the creeping authoritarianism within the media. Is this something that you've noticed?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I mean, like I'm no stranger to sort of being out on a limb in the media industry. I'm probably a bit of an outlier in a lot of ways in terms of my background and the things that I like to talk about and cover. So it doesn't necessarily bother me. But one thing I found like quite difficult last year in particular, being here in Melbourne during the second wave, it was obviously very stressful and exhausting for all of us. And I did a lot of reporting on the way that the state government mishandling of public health, and like really focusing on the fact that what went wrong here was a lack of long-term investment in public health capability. And that's kind of why the second wave got out of control, or overly reliant on private contractors and you know, management consultants to deal with these things. That's the problem. And the focus should be there rather than how to better police things. I copped so much blowback from so many people who thought it was the job of journalists or anyone with any kind of profile in the community to just support the state government. And to me, that's not the role of journalism. The role of journalism is to hold power to account. And that automatically puts you on a side. It puts you on the side of ordinary people who are at the whim of power, whether that power is powerful businesses, whether that's governments, whether that's powerful media organizations themselves. So I think that is a pretty good principle for journalism generally. I think a lot of journalists, unfortunately, lose sight of that, and they sometimes become part of the problem.
Yeah, like I definitely think that it became extremely clear, especially in Melbourne's second wave, that you could really see there is almost a big flag or sign just showing how underinvestment in health and education, and how the way that our society works in terms of having precarious workers on short-term contracts, forced to work in multiple workplaces, and obviously they're essential, so there's no way of doing it from home, and there's no way of locking down into a single workplace. And also a lot of these communities coming from migrant backgrounds where they're quite crowded because of the housing situation, and they live with their family members and everyone. That's where the second wave really started off, and people were completely unaware that it was happening because it's just outside the normal media sphere. And of course, when it happened, the immediate response was to call in the police, lock down the towers, and then create a ring of steel with using the military, which is using an authoritarian band-aid over these huge structural problems that go back to the Kennedy era and earlier.
Yeah, I mean, you're totally spot on. It's like over the past 3 decades, Australia has done, I mean, it's done a lot of things, but particularly in relation to sort of economic or industrial policy, it has completely gutted the public sector, particularly public health and education, as you said, and it has atomized and completely destroyed what was, not completely, but severely weakened the industrial relations system from the perspective of workers and labor. So we've got an extremely precariously employed working class that don't have adequate sick leave, you know, don't have the confidence to take time off to get tested or vaccinated, for example. So we've got these two things that have been slowly happening for the past 30 years. And then a pandemic hits, and the one thing you want in the pandemic is a strong public sector, public healthcare system, and workers that have, you know, proper conditions and pay, which we didn't have. And so it ripped right through those communities in particular. And so much is being made about Melbourne versus Sydney and how New South Wales handled it and how Victoria handled it. And all of that is a distraction from the fact that we're basically seeing the same thing in both these cities. We're seeing migrant, low-income communities who work in essential industries but have very little agency, who live in large share houses or with their families, who are forced to work, who don't have adequate pay to let them sit at home you know, watch Netflix like middle-class people like me, that is where the virus is ripping through. It's exactly what we saw in Singapore. It's what we saw in the United States, what we saw in the UK. It's the pattern of how this virus spreads. But in Australia, there's a deep unwillingness to grapple with that. Instead, we make it some kind of moral failing. You know, when we hear stories about how two Iraqi immigrant removalists, you know, broke the laws and brought the virus into regional New South Wales, rather than thinking why in the middle of a pandemic two migrants are working as subcontractors for a furniture removal company, that's clearly not something they're desperate to do, right? It's something that they're doing to put food on the table and a roof over their head. Our response isn't how do we change that? How do we fix these problems? It's to charge them, to send them in jail. Those guys have been charged and are in front of court right now. It's such a, from my perspective, a depressing set of affairs that we are willing to use criminal law and the police and the military to resolve this public health crisis.
One thing that I really think has been exposed is the way that quite a lot of people in the middle class, like, you know, a lot of my friends are in middle class educated type people, and there is just a complete lack of understanding about what a huge proportion of society is actually going through. And like there's this sort of virtuous feeling about, oh, if we all pull together and we do these little, you know, cute little things, you know, our Zoom phone calls and, you know, like then that's how we defeat the virus. And that anybody who goes against that is just so alien to a lot of, you know, people that I talk to, that they can't comprehend it, and they think they're not virtuous and that they need to be punished, you know.
Totally. It's a really interesting thing. And it's another thing that I think Australians are not very willing to talk about or grapple with. Like, I've lived in Sydney and Melbourne, you know, the two biggest cities in Australia, two of the most diverse cities in Australia and the world. But they're also cities that are deeply segregated on class and racial lines. I mean, I think Sydney more so than Melbourne, you know, where you can cut the city into the north and the east, which are deeply white and deeply middle class, and to the southwest and the west, which are heavily migrant areas. And Melbourne has similar, you know, kinds of population and demographic distribution. What that means is you have enormous waves of the population. Look at journalists, for example. It's like, you know, been very well documented that journalists live in, you know, these kind of white enclaves of, you know, the inner south or the inner north of Melbourne or the eastern suburbs or the inner west of Sydney, and they don't interact with the other part of the population. So they can't comprehend what's going on. And I see this in conversations I have or questions that get asked at press conferences. Like, how is this happening? How are these people still spreading the virus? It's just a complete unawareness that the people that are stacking your shelves in grocery stores, the people who are the contract cleaners doing deep cleans of high-risk environments, the nurses and the aged care workers, they don't live in Bondi. They don't live in Fitzroy. They live in these lower-income, out-of-suburban suburbs. They have to work. They live in larger houses, either through share houses or family. They can't just, you know, have Zoom cocktails every evening and group watch Netflix. And that's not me attacking people who do that. Like, everyone needs to grapple with this virus however they can. But you're totally right that there is a massive disconnect between how a lot of middle-class Australians perceive the world and what the actual reality of this country is.
We've got Ari here as well in the studio, so they've got a question for you.
Yeah, just on the issue of the disconnect, it's definitely making me think of the difference between last year. There was, you know, the virus came back from Aspen. And then, similar to the recent thing with the Iraqi removalists, there were some people who broke the lockdown in Victoria, some, I think, African young women who went up, you know, who left Victoria. And the massive stark difference in the way that they were treated.
Enemy of the state, I remember.
Yeah, exactly. Enemy of the state compared to, like, their pictures were on newspapers compared to these rich white people coming back from Aspen or whatever, who we never really heard about. It's just, oh, this is a thing that happened. Don't even worry about it. But then there are these scary brown people who are spreading the virus all over the place. It's that, like you said, that big disconnect where you have journalists living in the, pardon me, where you have journalists who are, you know, separating themselves to an extent from this, like, broader view of society, who then take that attitude of us versus them, of, you know, it's us. You know, white people, the whites probably whispered, versus everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating that we can name and see the photos of so many people who the government and journalists want to blame for this, and that overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, are people of color. Like you said, no one knows the name of the Aspen couple, you know, and it's not that I think that they should be named and shamed. I think no one should be named and shamed. But when you have one group of people who are and another group of people who haven't been, that kind of does show you how stark the problem is.
Yeah, and exactly. We've got Jacob here as well in the studio.
Yeah, so I just had a bit of a question because we're kind of getting, we probably have to conclude the interview a bit soon. And I guess this is just an important sort of question I think I sort of step in to sort of ask. But obviously, we all know in the last weekend, there was quite a large-sized anti-lockdown kind of protest, and in both Melbourne and in Sydney was probably
a lot bigger.
Oh, it was a lot bigger. And in fact, in Sydney, what I kind of observed was there was actually a much more diverse sort of ranges of kind of people present. Although overwhelmingly, my kind of assessment is overwhelmingly these kind of the politics of these protests is generally very right wing, and generally nothing that no left wing person can support. And I kind of want to just hear your kind of opinion on sort of the roots of some of these conspiracy theory type thinking, some of the far right politics that's kind of involved in some of these anti-lockdown protests, and how it kind of links with, I guess, all these sort of things that we've been talking about in terms of the terms of the government's response. Because ultimately, I kind of have the viewpoint that I don't necessarily think that, you know, people believing in these wild conspiracy theories are necessarily the cause. I think it's problematic, but I actually think a lot of the failure goes with government for allowing these kind of ideas to fester. So I think I want to kind of hear your kind of comments.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I'll try and be brief. So many different things. I could literally talk about this topic for 3 days, non-stop. Yeah. I've spent a bit of time in the last year talking to some of the actors involved in organizing these rallies, and it's so diverse, right? You've got a broad spectrum of people from anti-vax folk who've been anti-vax for a very long time, people who think that the pandemic is a attempt to create a new world order, to, you know, far-right agitators who are seeing an opportunity to create chaos or tap into a frustration. And a lot of that, regardless of where you sit or how sympathetic or not you are, not sympathetic to these organizers or attendees at all, a lot of it does stem from a long-term and growth of and they've figured it out and right side. But throughout history, when you see divisions rise, when you see class distinctions become sharper, and you see people lose faith with institutions, you see that polarization, and people can get drawn into different kinds of responses. And in this instance, we're seeing people being drawn into the kind of conspiratorial stuff. But I think you're also right that what we saw in Sydney this time was something slightly different. There was certainly that core of people I was explaining earlier, but there was also a different core. I think, like, calling them working class is perhaps not accurate. A lot of maybe like small business owners or tradie types who feel like the lockdown has financially impacted them, and they're not necessarily conspiracy theorists. They're protesting against what they see as a loss of income and impacts to their business. But I think what that shows, and I think what concerns me about that, is as this movement, as these lockdowns go on, as the pandemic continues to go on, and as people continue to be let down by governments on this, both state and federal, I don't see these rallies getting smaller. I see more and more people being drawn towards them for whatever reason. And I don't think that means we have to sympathize with them. I think what it speaks to is people on the left need to have a sharper critique of what's going on. I don't think saying, you're so stupid for not supporting the lockdown, why can't you just stay at home? How dare you be upset that you're losing income from this? I just don't think that's a rational politically strategic response. I think too much of the progressive side has just been a knee-jerk defensiveness of the role of government here in terms of policing and borders and military that we've been talking about. And I think the lockdown protests being so big are a reminder that there's a real risk here, that a lot of people who should be allies to this idea of expanding public health and of creating better working conditions might instead be drawn towards more far-right kind of thinking.
Well, we need to wrap up in a second, but do you have any more, like, final comments to make, maybe about the vaccine rollout and the sustainability of all of these just constant lockdowns and border.
Yeah, I think, look, we're at a point now where it's pretty clear that we're just going to be facing the risk of lockdowns until we get the country vaccinated. I know there's a lot of hesitancy around people wanting to get AstraZeneca. The government has
absolutely
messed up the supply of Pfizer. But I just think, you know, there's been so much self-interest in running down or attacking the vaccine rollout, and I think that has stymied things. I've got my vaccine appointment at 11 o'clock today. I think that's the only way out, really, and I encourage everyone who's in a position to do so to do it.
Yeah, me too. I got mine a couple of weeks ago. Bit of a fevery night of the first dose of AstraZeneca, but I've been telling everyone, just get it, you know.
Totally. That's the way out.
I mean, one final comment I kind of want to make is on that is, I mean, it's sort of, we're kind of in a kind of funny and a weird time, and I've sort of made this comment a few times to my partner and a few other people, that, you know, we're kind of living in this time where anti-vaxxers are actually probably very dangerous, because really, ultimately, you could probably get by in life without getting most of the vaccines that that are kind of mandatory at this stage, because, you know, we've killed most of those viruses in the community because of the vaccines themselves. But actually, the COVID-19 vaccine, if there was any time to get a vaccine and in your life, this is the time to get one.
I'm pretty sure it'll come to a time when you've either got the vaccine or you'll get the virus.
And in fact, that's actually what's happening in the United States right now, unfortunately, because there's actually a very strong anti-vaxxer kind of movement. But of course, it's all being propped up by Republicans and the whole right-wing kind of trajectory of that whole entire country.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for coming on the show, Osman.
Thanks so much for letting me, you know, have a pop-off about all of these things. Really appreciate it.
No, it's always good to have these views sort of talked about. There's so many issues and so many issues that are not really brought up by the mainstream media that just need to get an airing and to be discussed.
Great. PR rules. Yeah, thanks. Keep going.
Cool. Right.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for being on our program again. We really appreciated having you.
No worries.